Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the complete capture of the Republican Party by the far right, with Breitbart's Stephen Bannon, Roger Ailes and Laura Ingraham now apparently running Trump's campaign, and speak with Will Salatin, the national correspondent for Slate, who months ago likened Donald Trump to the GOP's warlord who has taken over the Republican Party as if it were a failed state. He joins us to discuss the cowardice of the Republican establishment in not taking a moral stand against the alt-right's racist appeals and hate speech, and the growing evidence of unprecedented intrusion by Trump's backer in the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, into our elections. We will look into the possibility of more to come in terms of foreign meddling in November's election and how much the tables have turned on us, given the CIA's long history of meddling in elections in the Third World, Japan, and Europe. Then, with the European Commission charging Apple with owing $14.5 billion in taxes it has not paid in Europe, owing to a sweetheart deal it has with the government of Ireland, we will speak with James Henry, a global justice fellow at Yale University and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. We will discuss the peculiar response in criticizing the move by the EU from the US Treasury that does not seem to be concerned that Apple is dodging US taxes by its fictional operation in Ireland, and how the battle between multinational corporations and states is shaping up, with Google, Facebook, and Microsoft the likely next targets for parking their profits in Ireland. Then finally, we will try to get some clarity on why the U.S.'s most effective proxy in its fight against the Islamic State, the Syrian Kurds, are under military attack from America's NATO ally Turkey, following a recent meeting between Vice President Biden and Turkey's President Erdogan, at which Biden clearly got played. A former foreign policy expert and senior advisor to the State Department under Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, joins us to discuss Turkey's intelligence service, the MIT's, continuing secret arrangement with the Islamic State, who are working with the Turks in their fight against America's most effective allies in the region, the YPG, People's Protection Forces of the Syrian Kurds. And joining us now is Will Salatin, who is the national correspondent at Slate, who writes about politics, science, and technology. He's the author of Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War. And his latest article at Slate is The Enemy Within. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Salatin.
Thanks for having me on.
And frankly, the enemy within could well be Donald Trump, in the sense that if the latest reports from the FBI, which they've heavily hinted at, that Russian hackers have been involved in tampering with, or at least extracting, voter rolls from Illinois and possibly inserting malware in the state of Arizona's election database, it doesn't take much of an extrapolation to recognize that if you want to really screw up American elections, you could essentially hack into these rolls, remove people that you don't want to vote, potential Democrats perhaps, and have them vote for Donald Trump. Or indeed, at the very moment of the election itself in November, you could hack the tallies, because there's so many of the touchscreens are still being used, as opposed to the optical scanners that have a paper trail. So a lot of our votes are unverified. So that's a long-winded way to say that this story that we're now looking at, given the record of Russian fingerprints on the hacking of the DNC, can you think reasonably that you can tie, at least in a speculative sense, Donald Trump to Vladimir Putin, trying to tip the scales for Trump?
Well, what a remarkable thing that this has come to pass. I mean, this is not the Democratic nominee, much less some communist. The Republican nominee for president. It's not speculation. It's fact that Vladimir Putin has praised Trump and that Trump has praised Putin. It's fact that Trump has embraced a foreign policy agenda that matches up perfectly with the agenda of Russia. Trump has obviously proposed to weaken, if not dissolve, NATO. He has endorsed the invasion and the seizure of Crimea by Russia. He has said the United States foreign policy should work with Russia, essentially ceding it its sphere of influence in Eastern Europe in exchange for helping us fight terrorism in the Middle East. So it's fact that it's also a fact that there has been cyber analysis of the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and other Democratic Party organs, and that the forensics show that it's related to Russian intelligence agencies. So what you have is the Republican nominee for president complaining out of one side of his mouth that the election is going to be rigged, while at the same time the only demonstrable evidence that anybody is actually trying to mess with the election is coming from his supporters, which is a foreign power.
Well, but I'm certainly not hawkish on NATO and NATO expansion. And I think when Putin first came in, he was quite accommodating, but he did make a turn about he's had a long tenure, but halfway through his tenure, to become quite hostile and quite paranoid about the West. But this goes beyond anything in terms of meddling or, you know, since he's a former KGB guy, of what most intelligence services are tasked with, which is getting information on potential enemies. So you could understand them snooping. But this is, if this is his real fingerprints, that he's actively involved in manipulating the elections, you can make the case that's a sort of an act of war against American democracy.
Yeah, it's there are a lot of people in the left side of the political spectrum in this country and in the Democratic Party who really aren't particularly interested in foreign policy. We don't want to fight wars. We don't want to get involved. We're in some ways more worried about American hawks causing damage around the world than we are about somebody like Saddam Hussein causing, you know, worldwide damage. But what we seem to have in this case is clear evidence that foreign intelligence agencies are messing with our elections. I would say the evidence that they are trying to affect the outcome of the election by doing actual election fraud, messing with the counting of votes, is less clear than the evidence that they're messing with it by hacking into Democratic Party organs, seizing information, and trying to release that in a way that will damage one candidate. And, of course, this is the kind of thing that has gone on in Russia and in some other sort of only semi-democratic, semi-totalitarian or authoritarian countries where the apparatus of the state government is used to try to influence elections in all kinds of ways. So, I think we need to be serious and sensible about this. And a lot of people who don't worry about something like a Russian military invasion of Europe ought to take seriously that the new form of warfare isn't really so much on the battlefield. It's in cyber espionage and hacking. That's certainly what a lot of military analysis in our country and around the world has shown in the last several years. And you can argue that's what's happening here.
And again, I'm speaking with Will Salton, who is the national correspondent at Slate, who writes about politics, science, and technology. He's the author of Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War. And his latest article at Slate is The Enemy Within. So if indeed, we know there are Russian FSB and SVR fingerprints on Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, the hacks into the DNC, and we know that Julian Assange dumped them on the eve of the Democratic Convention, which certainly infuriated Bernie Sanders supporters, although it was pretty clear all along that the DNC were tipping the scales for Hillary. So that does look like direct interference. But in terms of the idea of, in effect, an act of war on democracy, we're speculating because the elections in November, already Illinois was hacked back in July, and they were shut down for over 10 days, their election system. So if that's a rehearsal, we could be in for a bit of a surprise in October, given how dysfunctional our electoral system is and being a patchwork of state-controlled election systems.
Yeah, it's not clear what would happen here because we've never had a test of this magnitude. I mean, we've never had an intelligence. We've never had hackers who have the sophistication of the Russian intelligence agencies try to take on an election in this country in the way that's being alleged here. Now, for that reason, I think we should be skeptical both ways, Ian. I don't think we should assume that. I don't think we should lose trust in the reporting of election results over this, because it may all be bluster. It may be like Y2K, something that we're all warned. Everything will collapse. The data won't be reliable, and it may turn out that, in fact, very little was accomplished. But I do think we should take it as a warning. I mean, it's not just in our election systems. It's in our government generally and in all kinds of information networks in this country that we have not really geared up for this level of hacking. You know, we think of hackers as some kids in a garage somewhere, but the Russians and Chinese are quite accomplished and have managed to break into all kinds of systems. For goodness sake, we proved that we could break into the Iranian systems and completely mess up their nuclear program. So this is increasingly the most effective form of espionage around the world and the most effective form of meddling in disinformation and influencing other countries in some ways. So I think we should be prepared that it can happen to us, and I think we do have some time to prepare for this possibility and improve our cybersecurity for the November election.
And, of course, there's a fundamental difference between extracting information and manipulating information or using it to advantage one candidate over another. But
we should say about that, one interesting thing about that is I know plenty of people who, for example, Bernie Sanders supporters, who would say, well, I'm glad we found out about what the DNC was doing to our guy. We thought this all along. We're glad the information is out there. We don't begrudge WikiLeaks publishing it. We don't particularly care how it got there. This information should be known. People who believe in transparency, and I understand that. I think we should also be aware that when somebody is hacking and releasing information like this with an agenda, we're only getting the part of the story they want us to hear. They're not, for example, hacking into the Republican National Committee, or they're not releasing that information. And we shouldn't be naive. We should ask ourselves, why is it we're being told this side of the story and not the other side?
Well, I follow the Russian press, and it's no question that the they're all in, the state-controlled media in particular, which is 90% of the media in Russia, is all in for Donald Trump, and they're quite unabashed about it. And what I'm told from a lot of Russian sources and experts on Russia here in the United States is that Putin himself really blames the U.S. for the color revolutions. He believes that they've interfered in his backyard, and he blames Hillary Clinton specifically for the 2011-2012 demonstrations in the streets of Moscow against Putin's extension of his tenure. And, you know, there's obviously a very, unpleasant personal relationship between the two of them. Putin feels that she was stiffed him because he invited her to go to Siberia with him to observe the tigers, because he honestly believes he's an environmentalist, even though he tends to have photo opportunities with tigers that have been from the zoo that have been drugged. but nevertheless, the point I'm trying to make here is that my understanding is that the reason that the fingerprints are clear coming from Russia and coming from Putin is that that's what he's saying. He's in our face. He's saying, you guys have screwed with us. Now this is payback. We're screwing with you. Is that a possibility?
It's certainly a possibility. We know that this is Putin's agenda. And if you turn it around, I don't want to say it's all nefarious. I mean, I think Putin's a thug. But also, if you put yourself in his shoes as the president of Russia, the United States and the West did everything that we could to push the Soviets out of Eastern Europe to dissolve their control of that space. And then going further, you know, we helped the breakup of the Soviet Union itself. That has weakened Russia in many ways. We've certainly fed the nationalisms that helped dissolve the Soviet Union. And I think Putin is doing to us in a way what we did to him. He's feeding nationalism, mostly in Europe. In countries like, you know, Greece and Italy and Hungary. But he's also trying to feed nationalism here. If you were Putin and you saw a candidate rise to the level of the Republican nomination for president in the United States who thinks and talks like Donald Trump, who preaches a brand of nationalism that could dissolve NATO, for goodness sake, you would do everything possible to help that guy. So it makes perfect sense from Putin's point of view. What would be foolish of us is not to take account of that and to somehow think, well, Donald Trump presents himself as a tough guy, as a nationalist, as America first, and therefore he's the hawk. He's not the hawk. He's the pigeon in this race. He is, in effect, Putin's stooge, even though I don't think subjectively he sees himself that way at all.
Well, but just what you've just said, Will Salatin, if the Democrats weren't so feckless, this would be, I think, a massive campaign theme, because the evidence is there. Now, I understand how the binary nature of our press gives Trump an advantage, because he can preempt her presenting evidence about his bigotry by just calling her a bigot, and he gets equal exposure. But that notwithstanding, the fact of the matter is that the evidence is pretty powerful that Russia is manipulating this election, this season, and Trump is their guy, and that flies in the face of decades of Cold War Republican policy, which you'd think would really make the Republicans uncomfortable. And of course, for example, in terms of House and Senate races, I cannot understand why the Democrats aren't seizing on Republican obstruction of Zika funding, which is all going to happen in red states in the South, all of which voted for riders, for example, that stymied any efforts to fund Zika eradication and prevention, were, riders to defund Planned Parenthood, defund the Clean Water Act, and protect the Confederate flag. So if the Republicans in the House think the protecting the Confederate flag is more important than saving pregnant American women from the anxiety of giving birth to a child with microcephaly, then I don't understand what a political issue is.
Yeah, well, I, to be fair, I haven't followed enough of the down-ballot Democrats and what they're saying or not saying. I know that I have seen, some reports of candidates bringing up Zika, but they haven't pushed that as much as they might. I would give Hillary Clinton's campaign full marks for capitalizing, so to speak, on the Russian angle in the presidential election. For example, in her speech last week about the alt-right, about the sort of racist right in this country, she devoted a considerable section of that speech to Trump's Russian ties. I mean, that was a speech very well designed to give moderate Republicans and even hawkish Republicans who simply recognize Trump as what he is, what the Clinton campaign has called a permission structure. She has basically said, Trump does not represent conservative or Republican values in a number of issue areas, and therefore you should feel fully comfortable calling yourself a Republican and a conservative and rejecting Trump. I'm not asking you to surrender your philosophy. I'm not asking you to agree with me on everything, but we can all agree that this guy is bad. And so one of the main elements that she introduced in that speech was the idea that Trump is doing the bidding of Putin, and that any Republican who thinks of him or herself as a foreign policy hawk, as someone who believes in American national security, that there are bad forces out there and that we need to be vigilant against them, that the first thing you should be vigilant against is a takeover from within, the anointment of an American president who does not recognize Putin for the threat he is.
Well, you're almost talking about the Manchurian candidate there. But let's talk a little bit in the last couple of minutes, Will Salatin, with a piece that you wrote several months ago, Donald Trump is the GOP's warlord and the Republican Party is officially a failed state. Given that the latest indications are that the Trump campaign is really being run by Breitbart's Stephen Bannon, and Roger Ailes and Laura Ingraham are the real people that he's listening to and who are in constant contact with him, and that Kellyanne Conway is a sort of affront, some adult supervision in terms of reaching out to the soccer mums and to make Republicans feel that they're not racist if they vote for Donald Trump. It seems to me that this is really... Is this the future of the party? I mean, it seems like it's irreconcilable at a certain point, the traditional Chamber of Commerce wing and the Tea Party wing that Trump has motivated. Do you see a collision, a crash, a split? And if so, who will end up with the rump of the Republican Party?
I can't predict the future on that. It's a really interesting question. What's happened certainly is what Donald Trump said has happened. He says, I'm an outsider. I'm rejecting the elites. I'm rejecting the elites in my own party as well as in the other party. He's right about that. He represents an invasion of the Republican Party that has been going on for some time, but they have now, it's kind of a guerrilla operation that has now grown to essentially dominate the party. And it's a guerrilla force of know-nothings. There's nothing to be proud of here. These are not people who stand for, who truly stand for the forgotten people. This is a backlash of the of some sort of old nativist right-wing instincts. And it's a backlash against not just cosmopolitanism, but intellectualism. It's against free trade. It's against liberalism in the sense of, you know, a belief in the equality of people. I mean, Trump is now trying to make some noises to get away from what he has been. But this is a revolution that has been going on for some time, and I am fully willing to blame the former establishment of the Republican Party for their cowardice in having failed to confront this menace earlier, to kick it out of their party. I mean, Hillary Clinton, in that alt-right speech, delivered a quite bracing litany of recollections about past Republican presidential nominees and how they stood up to these people. She talked about Bob Dole, the 1996 Republican nominee, telling racists to get out of the convention hall. Anyone who was in there who was a racist, he wanted them out. She talked about John McCain at an event, I forget whether it was in New Hampshire, but it was a presidential campaign event at which someone said that that Barack Obama, at that time a senator, was a Muslim, was a secret Muslim and an enemy of the United States. And John McCain said, no, you are wrong. He is a decent person. And now what we have is a candidate in Donald Trump who encourages this behavior among his people. He's a product of these people. So essentially, the moderate, sane elite of the Republican Party failed to address sufficiently in recent years this uprising of know-nothings, and the know-nothings are now running the party. And sadly, that wreckage it has now not just ruined their party, but it's bleeding over into the rest of the country. As to what happens to the Republican Party, the establishment, as it was, is going to have to reassert itself. I do think there is some hope. I do think that there are a lot of Republicans out there and a lot of conservative-leaning independents who are sane people who are repelled by Donald Trump. And maybe these people tolerated the dog whistles to racism of the last 20, 30, 40 years, but Trump has made it explicit in a way that has revolted these folks. And it's not just that. It's him selling out to Putin. It's his just abandonment of principle on almost any issue. So I'm hopeful that the negative example of Trump will provoke enough of these people to say, we need to reconstitute the Republican Party of old, the party of Lincoln. Or, if they have to leave the Republican Party, to constitute a new party that can represent conservatism. Because I do think it's important for there to be a right-of-center, conservative-leaning party in this country. But it needs to be a sane party. It can't be the party of Trump.
Well, we will see. So far, there's not been any display of a moral backbone. The best excuse the Republican establishment has for its lack of moral fiber is that we have to vote for Trump in order to stop Hillary Clinton from stacking the Supreme Court with liberals. That means, in other words, the executive branch can be led by an unstable, reckless, and completely unqualified person, which will do untold wreckage, all to save the Supreme Court. Hardly a moral stance. So I guess we shall wait to see, right? Stay tuned. Mm-hmm. Is that the best note we can end on?
Yeah, I can't. I've often predicted and often been wrong, and I tend to be sanguine. I am hopeful. I do think the opportunity is there, and it's really up to the. It will take courage in the center right of this country to reject Trump and to try to reconstitute a Republican Party worthy of the name.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Will Salatin.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Salatin, who's the national correspondent at Slate, who writes about politics, science, and technology. He's the author of Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War, and his latest article at Slate is The Enemy Within. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the charge by the European Commission that Apple owes $14.5 billion in taxes it's not paid in Europe because of a sweetheart deal it has with the government of Ireland. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey Company. He's now a global justice fellow at Yale University and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be here.
And there's quite a flap going on in Europe between Apple and the Irish government and the European Commission, who after a three-year investigation concluded that Apple's Irish firm, their tax benefits are illegal and that they owe about $14.5 billion in back taxes. They've in effect been paying a corporate tax rate of about 1% in Ireland. Both the Irish government and Apple are appealing. But what do you think is going on here? Some people are looking at this as a battle between multinational corporations and states.
Well, I think what's going on is that the EU Commission has finally had it with some of the games that U.S. multinationals in particular have been playing with some of their own member states, like not only Ireland, but Luxembourg and the Netherlands. And these are basically, these games are costing them tax revenue. In the Apple case, they negotiated a very special deal to allow them to have essentially shell companies that are citizens of nowhere for tax purposes, not citizens of Ireland or the United States, to be set up. And Ireland already had a 12.5% corporate tax rate, which is about less than half of the U.S. rate. But Apple wasn't satisfied with that, so they went in and negotiated an exclusive deal for themselves. Basically, over the last since 2000 or so, they paid less than 4% corporate taxes on more than $200 billion of offshore profits and royalties. And that, by the way, that isn't just determined by the objective location of their activities offshore. They basically reallocated a lot of their intellectual property, their patents and their software and trademarks, to Ireland, subsidiaries in Ireland and Bermuda and Luxembourg, kind of a triangular arrangement whereby they were allowed to pay themselves royalties tax-free on billions and billions of dollars of intellectual property. So, the offshore nature of this is something that was created. It wasn't, sort of God-given. I think the really shameful thing here is the way the U.S. Treasury has responded to this. Rather than embracing the Europeans for, trying to finally put an end to tax competition, we've had 30 years of country after country slashing corporate tax rates and allowing more of these haven games to be played by multinationals. The U.S. Treasury just went out and basically declared a tax war with Europe. I mean, just expressing outrage that Europe was going to transfer money from the U.S. Treasury to its own member states and threatening to, discourage American companies from investing in Europe. The Europeans were quite, I think, reasonable in their and measured, and they were careful to measure the actual, excess tax benefits to Apple as a result of these deals. They went around to every country and looked at, Germany, for example, calculated that it had lost tax revenue from Apple's sales in Germany of about 1.3 billion euros. And they added up similar calculations for every country in Europe, and just to see how much of this had been simply parked in Ireland. The Irish are upset because this is a business for them. They've become a tax haven, and so they're looking forward to the future being a little bit different from the past, and they wanted to keep on playing these games, which are really a kind of beggar-thy-neighbor strategy with respect to their partners in Europe. But it would be easy for the Obama administration to have done something about this. They didn't have to declaim the Europeans. They would simply have to, crack down on some of Apple's, practices here. And then the Europeans said, well, if Apple were actually buying real services from the parent company back in the United States or doing real research, we would be happy to acknowledge that. But they're not. These are basically shell games. And unfortunately, it's played by a lot of U.S. companies. It's the same kind of game is played by almost every other software company. Pfizer, the drug pharmaceutical industry, Amazon, Google, all of these same players have been hauled over the coals in Europe for basically parking their profits in Europe elsewhere in low-tax havens. And I think the real issue that this exposes and underlines is the fact that we don't have international tax regime for taxing big companies that is a level playing field. So all these games can be played by multinationals, but you have small businesses, not able to take advantage, and so they get hit. I think that's essentially what the European Commission has said, is that this is really unfair competition for a whole lot of European companies.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is now a global justice fellow at Yale University and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. So, in effect, the fact that Apple is in Ireland, where it's made a sweetheart deal, instead of paying the 12.5% corporate tax in Ireland, it pays somewhere between 1% and 4% on its European profits. So being in Ireland is their way into the EU, and that's why the EU is complaining. But also being in Ireland allows Apple to avoid U.S. taxes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they're transferring assets, intellectual property, to Ireland that would otherwise be here and, be subject to a much higher tax rate. So the royalties on those taxes, royalties paid to their own, for their own patents here would be higher. So there are, these are games that the tax departments, all these multinationals have been playing. They aren't uncaused causes, though. The games have developed a relatively short period of time since the mid-90s when some of the accounting firms, lobbyists in Washington got together with the software companies of the world and, went to Congress and to the Treasury and got special rules and regulations designed. It's been really since the late 1990s that this whole tax game has been designed by the multinationals' lobbyists. There's about 1,800 tax lobbyists in Washington, and they're just, they're not working for you and me. So Apple will say, and, I've heard Tim Cook speak on this, that we're obeying the law, none of this is illegal. I mean, sadly, that's true. The Congress is not able to crack down on it. The corporate lobby is just too powerful. And it's not only in the United States, but it's also been true in the UK and, major European capitals. I'm looking forward to the EU going on from targeting Ireland, which is relatively politically sort of weak, to targeting Luxembourg or Netherlands, which have much more political clout. They're playing many of the same games with multinationals.
But Apple, for example, had a net profit of $53 billion in the 2015 financial year. It has a market capitalization of $600 billion. And it's not alone in using Ireland as a way to avoid U.S. taxes and EU taxes by making the sweetheart deal with Ireland. Google is also doing it, so is Facebook and Microsoft. So are they going to be targeted as well? Is this a kind of a prelude to going after these other tax dodgers?
Well, some people have said this is a tax war that's going to be starting. I hope it doesn't come to that. I think what we need is really tax collaboration among countries to sort of figure out a peaceful coexistence here. Europe also has companies that play these games offshore. They want to be able to invest in the United States at a reasonable tax rate. We basically don't. If we turn this into a kind of a zero-sum game, I think we're missing the point. What's needed is a change in the kind of tax competition, the race to the bottom among countries that's been going on since the 1990s, since the 1980s, really, where one country after another, the United States, the UK, Canada, would cut tax rates, and then they'd follow with kind of a whole cycle of similar cuts. That kind of tax competition has been unhealthy. It hasn't created jobs. It's been very unproductive for the world's economy, and it's transferred a lot of the essential costs of government to those who are not able to shift their tax burdens to havens, middle class businesses and working people and the poor. So I think it'd be much healthier if the Obama administration would say, hey, let's all get together and reinvigorate the OECD's effort to reform the international corporate tax system, which is now kind of stalled, so-called BEPS tax reform effort. We need to get rid of the tax competition that's been unhealthy and replace it with tax collaboration among countries that I think to establish fair rates of taxation on companies across countries.
So the U.S. Treasury, and this is kind of mystifying. Last week they said that the European Commission was in danger of becoming a supranational tax authority. And in regard to this ruling against Apple for $14.5 billion in U.S. in taxes owed because of their sweetheart deal with Ireland following this investigation, this three-year investigation by the European Commission, our Treasury says that the latest ruling from the European Commission could undermine foreign investments, the business climate in Europe, and the important spirit of economic partnership between the U.S. and the EU. That does seem extraordinary. You would think that the U.S. Department of Treasury, of which the IRS is a part, would be focused on, since everybody's saying the sky is falling because of the U.S. deficits, Donald Trump never misses an opportunity to say we have a crippling debt. And all this nonsense goes on in our political debate about how much we're in debt. And the only people that collect revenues are the IRS. And if these guys in the Treasury Department aren't 100% in favor of collecting revenues, then what the hell is their job?
Well, I think what they're arguing, and I think it's just wrong, but they're claiming that if companies like Apple have to pay more taxes in Europe, they will be found the money that they pay will be deemed to be deductible against the U.S. tax base. And so they were claiming in this white paper the Treasury put out last week that this would result in a direct transfer of tax revenue from the U.S. to Europe. But what this ignores is the fact that a lot of that stuff is not going to be deductible against the U.S. tax base in the United States because there's no economic rationale for it. It's really the kind of the U.S. tax system that has created this whole two-part system. We have, if you have a domestic business, you have a corporate tax rate federal level of 35%, and state may add another 3 or 4% to that. If you have, however, offshore income outside the United States, or if you park your intellectual property and other assets offshore, like Apple has done, pay yourself royalties tax-free, you don't get taxed on your offshore income until you repatriate it. It's a so-called deferral provision. And this deferral provision, which really only big multinationals can take advantage of, is going to cost us about $1.3 trillion over the next 10 years. We really have to look at this split-level system that we have, which no other country really has, for taxing corporate income. It says, you know, as long as you can park it in, across the street in Europe, you can borrow against it, you can bring it back, you can deduct the interest, but you leave it offshore in a bookkeeping fashion. There's now about $2.4 trillion of U.S. multinational profits that have been parked offshore that are deferring taxes. Either we should tax it at the same level as the United States, or we should give it a small incentive to bring it home. And if it's invested in jobs and real investment, maybe it can qualify for a lower tax rate. But, you know, the Bush administration, 2004, had a one-time kind of amnesty for offshore investment and, didn't really ask anything of the companies that brought back profits and gave them a 5% tax rate. That's not what we need here. But we do have a real need to address the need for reform in the U.S. tax system. It's in the corporate tax in particular. Stop blaming the Europeans who are being targeted by the Treasury Department and blamed for this behavior.
So just in closing then, if the European Commission is successful in demanding these 13 billion euro back taxes from Ireland, if Ireland is giving a sweetheart deal and if Apple were paying the 12.5% corporate tax in Ireland, would this not be an issue? Or is this a money grab from the Commission itself for the rest of Europe?
Well, Europeans have said that, if the United States can it would be a money grab for the United States if we would were able to show that there was real activities engaged in by Apple in any of these places. The European Commission has said that they would be happy to share the $14 billion with the United States. But pending that, they're going to be allocating this to the places that real sales went on, that real research went on, that real employment was generated, and that could be, anywhere in Europe. The point is that this kind of a one-off deal for Apple, a sweetheart deal, really, it's a kind of deal that Luxembourg has also been engaged in. I think it doesn't serve the purpose of stimulating healthy competition in Europe. It's done behind closed doors. It's really unfair to the smaller companies that are trying to compete with players like Apple. I'm looking at the list of the largest Irish companies right now. They're all basically foreigners. You have Accenture, the big accounting firm, Medtronic, Allergan, which is a big drug company, Tyco International, Seagate Technology, which is originally a California-based technology company, but they're now headquartered in Ireland because of the tax system. I mean, all of this artificial kind of activity is distressing because it's just distracting technology-based businesses from what they really should be worried about, which is making outstanding products. Maybe it's a signal that Apple is sending us, that they have time to worry about, their tax situation because they've run out of ideas in the base business. I hope that's not the case, but you don't really see a lot of startups sort of playing these games so aggressively.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Very welcome. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is now a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking for some clarity on why the U.S.'s most effective proxy in its fight against the Islamic State, the Syrian Kurds, are under military attack from America's NATO ally, Turkey.
Take a walk, I'll tax your feet.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Phillips, the Director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Postwar Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Erdogan's Waterloo, Turkey Invades and Occupies Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
So this is a very confusing situation, I'm sure, for most of our listeners, David, to try and understand why it is that America's most effective proxy in the fight against the Islamic State are the Syrian Kurds, and now they're being beaten up by America's and NATO ally, Turkey. So what is going on?
It is confusing. Turkey has always been a steadfast ally of the United States and a member in good standing of NATO. Recently, the U.S. has relied more heavily on the Syrian Kurds to take on ISIS in Syria. To Turkey, the Syrian Kurds are an extension of the PKK, a group with which it's waged a struggle over almost 40 years. The PKK has been fighting for greater political and cultural rights of Kurds. Finally, Erdogan has made the decision that he was going to send Turkish forces into Syria. He said it was to go and defeat ISIS, but in fact, we see from Turkey's actions over the past couple of days that the mission is almost entirely directed against the People's Protection Forces, which is a Kurdish-Syrian militia closely allied to the United States. Confusing it is, but there's need for moral clarity. The U.S. and the Kurds have been working hand in glove. The U.S. knows that it doesn't want to be drawn into a quagmire in Syria. It'll continue to support the Syrian Kurds and to constrain Turkey's offensive, because having two allies fighting each other on the front lines of the war against ISIS serves no one except the Islamic State.
So how did this happen, though, with the appearance of U.S. complicity? Because Vice President Joe Biden was in Ankara last week. His mission was to repair U.S. Turkey's relations, which have really tanked since the aborted coup, and Erdogan has blamed the U.S. for its complicity, or at the very least, in not supporting him vigorously enough. And the Turkish people, because of Erdogan's control of the media, believe that the U.S. was behind this coup, or this failed coup, along with Gulen, the exiled religious leader living here in the United States, being the alleged mastermind. So that was Joe Biden's job, apparently. But he also endorsed this military operation by Turkey known as Operation Euphrates Shield. So did Biden get taken?
Yes, Vice President Biden was played by President Erdogan of Turkey. He got off the plane in Ankara. He was told that there was a military operation underway, that it was going to be finite and of limited scope. Because he was there to repair relations, probably the decision was made on the spot for Biden to speak in support of the operation and to send a warning to the Syrian Kurds to stay east of the Euphrates as a way of deconflicting Turkey and the Syrian Kurds. In fact, the operation has turned into a much bigger project. Turkish forces are pushing south. They seized Jarablus with almost no opposition. Now they're moving on Manbij, a city about 30 kilometers southeast. Turkey's actions are a direct betrayal of the commitments that Turkey made to Vice President Biden. I'm sure right now in the White House they are hopping mad about Turkey's misrepresentation.
But what's confusing here is that if there was some kind of agreement for the YPG to stay east of the Euphrates, there's also a pocket of Syrian Kurds to the west, is there not, on the border with Turkey? And
so the U.S. Let me see if I can address that question. The U.S. has been providing close air support and weapons to the Syrian Kurds, the YPG. The understanding was that when they crossed the Euphrates and moved on Manbij and then on Jarablus, that they would have a temporary foothold there and would ultimately withdraw east of the Euphrates River. In the middle of this, Turkey invaded, which has greatly complicated the whole picture. When Vice President Biden sent a warning to the Syrian Kurds last week, it was a message to withdraw from its positions west of the Euphrates. Otherwise, the U.S. would discontinue its assistance, which also includes special forces. Apparently, the YPG has withdrawn to the east of the Euphrates, although there are conflicting reports about that. But I think, you know, the bottom line here is that the U.S. has no friends in Syria except the Syrian Kurds. It should honor that relationship. It will continue to support the Syrian Kurds, particularly if they are in lockstep with the Pentagon's war plan. The introduction of Turkish forces has greatly complicated the picture. Now we have U.S. allies fighting each other. The U.S. never wanted to have to make a decision between Turkey and the Kurds. Erdogan is trying to force that decision, and that's in nobody's interest.
And again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book just out is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Erdogan's Waterloo, Turkey Invades and Occupies Syria. Well, we know that Erdogan has, in fact, reignited the war with the PKK, the Kurdish resistant forces, with whom they had a truce, in order to gain more executive authority. And then this aborted coup, this failed coup, of course, has been a huge gift to him. And he's cracked down, eviscerated almost all press opposition. I think he has more control over Turkey than Putin does, and Putin at least calls what he has in Russia managed democracy. Meanwhile, Erdogan is pretending that Turkey is a democracy that was saved from a coup. But meanwhile, having supported the Islamic State and become a kind of underground railroad for Islamic State fighters coming in from Europe, according to your Huffington Post article, about 500 Islamist fighters are still transiting from Turkey to Syria each month. So here you have Turkey itself being subjected to suicide bombings by the Islamic State, and yet they still appear to be, if not operating an underground railroad, at least tolerating an underground railroad for jihadis.
Since 2014, Turkey has actively supported Islamist groups in Syria. It provided money, weapons, logistical assistance. When they were wounded on the battlefield, they were taken back to Turkish hospitals, no questions asked, provided with medical treatment. The infrastructure that existed in 2014 and 2015 is still in place. And Turkey's National Intelligence Agency, which managed assistance to the Islamic State, is still active in supporting them. At the same time, Erdogan has suffered enormous pressure from the U.S. to start cracking down. It started with a decision to allow the U.S. use of Incirlik Air Force Base outside of Adana for a more rapid response to ISIS operations in Syria and Iraq. You saw increasing jargon coming out of the Islamic State, out of its media, linking Erdogan and Obama. At the same time, over the past year, you've seen at least three terrorist attacks in Turkey. for which the Islamic State has been blamed. Turkey is still ideologically aligned with the Islamic State. The Justice and Development Party of Tayyip Erdogan is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, just like the Islamists in Syria are. Turkey's been trying to play both ends of the fence by helping the U.S. While it continues to aid and abet ISIS. It can't have it both ways. And the U.S. needs to be clear on Turkey's role. Even this operation in Jarablus, I have a conversation with a very well-placed Turk who was on the border. Apparently, there was no fighting in Jarablus whatsoever. A deal was made in advance between the National Intelligence Agency and ISIS. They would stand down. In fact, there's a report that they just simply changed uniforms from their ISIS garb into garb of the Free Syrian Army. All this was orchestrated by Turkey. The civilians who were in Jarablus were evacuated, unlike every other battle where the civilians were used as human shields. My source on the ground tells me that Turkey did that in order to eliminate eyewitness accounts that would report that the Free Syrian Army, which is now in Jarablus, are simply ISIS fighters who have changed military uniforms and are now there acting in cooperation with their Turkish partners. This is an uncorroborated report, but it stands the test of time because this has happened before. Even the attacks by ISIS in Turkey, a senior official who's in exile from the anti-corruption department of the police says, was actually organized by Turkey's national intelligence in order to justify the maneuver in Jarablus. There's a lot of conspiracy theories swirling around. One thing is clear. Turkey is an uncertain ally. It's proven itself an unreliable member of NATO. Because Erdogan is Islamist, anti-democratic and fundamentally anti-Western, there are serious questions about Turkey's suitability as an ally. What's happening now in Syria just underscores concerns about whether Turkey can be counted as a member of the multinational coalition.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Erdogan's Waterloo, Turkey Invades and Occupies Syria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.